From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll speak with two people with Wisconsin ties who'll be taking part in this week's International Climate Summit in San Francisco.
Later, political writer Mark Leibovich spends a year talking with the NFL owners and tells fans of the publicly owned Packers, you aren't missing much.
You know, sports is not my day job. I'm not a sports writer. I'm a political writer. And I'll say that if you're putting together like an elite corporate board of like, you know, Federal Express or Bank of America or Apple or something, you would not pick a lot of these guys to be on your elite corporate board.
And metalsmith Sarah Mann says the jewelry she makes has changed over time based partly on her own tastes.
All the jewelry that I make over the years has always been something that I've wanted to wear myself before presenting it to the public.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In 2015, the United Nations convened the 21st Annual Climate Change Conference in Paris, France. Hundreds of people gathered, not only official delegates, but people like Clay Nessler as well. Nessler is Vice President of Sustainability with Johnson Controls.
2015 in Paris was very significant because countries came together and agreed on a new approach which would address the challenge of climate change and try to keep temperatures below the 2 degrees C limit. It was based on intended nationally determined contributions in that each country essentially came up with a plan and a commitment or a commitment range of what they would contribute collectively to achieving that 2 degree target.
Another Wisconsin attendee was La Crosse-based pediatrician Jeff Thompson, CEO emeritus of Gunderson Health System. Gunderson has dramatically reduced its carbon footprint in recent years.
We define the health as both your physical health, how you breathe, how your heart's working, whether you have asthma attacks or not, but also economic health. And so we said we will stop hurting our patients and our community with the pollution generated from our energy sources, and we would do it in a way that would save the system money and improve the local economy.
President Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement, but international meetings continue to push plans forward, and with Americans like Thompson and Nessler still at the table.
This week, San Francisco is hosting a summit, and Dr. Thompson and Clay Nessler will be there. Lake Effect Susan Benz talked with each of them by phone before they headed west.
We'll hear first from Johnson Controls' Clay Nessler. Back in 2015, Susan met him in Milwaukee, where Nessler described his company's approach to sustainability. He's now based in Washington, D.C., and Nessler gave Susan Benz a preview of some of the innovations that will be featured in the summit, which begins tomorrow.
There's a new initiative called Science-Based Targets, where essentially you use the best climate science available to identify what goals within your industry sector should you target in order to contribute on a fair and equitable basis to the mitigation of climate change. So we're at this point, we've improved the energy productivity of our operations, which is the amount of revenue generated per BTU or gigajoule of energy use, by over 90%. So this is something that we have committed to early as a company. We've set aggressive goals. We've met those goals ahead of schedule, and we will continue in the future to make goals very consistent with what we are able to do practically, as well as setting goals that are what is really required to achieve the targets of the Paris Agreement.
So back to the science-based targets, where did that formula or their template come from?
There's a number of organizations working together to work with organizations to help them define what are called science-based targets for carbon reduction within your own footprint, your use of electricity, your use of gas, the transportation fuel use of your fleets. But they also include being able to influence your supply chain, both the embodied energy and carbon in the materials that you would source to manufacture your products, as well as the impact of your products through use and end of life. It's so a very rigorous approach. And one of the big objectives of the Global Climate Action Summit is the chairman of Mahindra challenged other companies to set science-based targets with a goal of 500 organizations committing to set those targets in the future. We are one of those companies. And I don't know if we've hit 500, but I know we were very close last week. So stay tuned on that.
Is that then going to be the centerpiece of your conversations with people when at the summit, this particular target?
To some extent, yes. That is something that is certainly new and incremental, which we are bringing forth. But there's something called the Carbon Smart Buildings Day, which I'll be involved in and speaking at, which is really focused on a particular sector, the building sector. And of course, that's near and dear to our technology and solutions business based in Milwaukee. And the discussion there will be how can the building sector contribute what it could and should towards the Paris goals, with a very high and ambitious goal of having all new construction in 2030 be net zero carbon, and plans to convert existing buildings into net zero carbon by 2050. These are very aspirational goals, but exactly the kind of thing which makes people think differently about the issue. A lot of the carbon in the construction industry is actually in the materials, the steel, the cement that are used to build new buildings. And of course, many of those buildings are being built outside the United States, in China, India, and other developing countries. So there's a ripple effect of really addressing buildings, not only making a more efficient, greater use of renewable energy, energy storage can make their operation more efficient, but we're thinking even broader about how to reduce the amount of carbon or energy used in the materials, and potentially someday maybe even being able to store some of that carbon in the materials. And buildings are expected to have to contribute almost half of the greenhouse gas reductions over the 2050 time period. So that is a very great priority for many in the industry and most of the countries that are focused on the Paris Agreement.
When we talked what seems like a long time ago in 2015, you mentioned that the private sector is important to solving climate change challenges. And you talked about some governments being far more aggressive in their goals and their involvement than others. What's your read on the balance of the importance of those two?
Yeah, so at least in the buildings area, which we're closest to at Johnson Controls, a lot of the action takes place in cities. That's where building codes are established and enforced. That's where the construction is. The improvements that we need to make are very local. Someone has to come in and insulate a home. They have to replace incandescent bulbs with LED bulbs. All that work happens locally. And it's local leadership at a city and in some cases a state level that really drive the improvements. Government's a very broad term, and I think we see a lot of leadership. I think we see a lot of ambition, and I think we see a lot of impact coming from cities, which, you know, with urbanization and with the rising middle class, particularly outside the U.S., I think there's great urgency and relying on city and local governments to show the leadership there.
So you're not spending time knocking on doors at Capitol Hill?
I still spend time knocking on doors in Washington. We work very closely with the Department of Energy, with the State Department on international issues, with the Environmental Protection Agencies. Those programs are still underway. I just got back from the Better Buildings Summit in Cleveland, Ohio, which is a very large DOE event. Much of the activities that were created over, in some cases, decades are business as usual and moving forward. And we look to where the leadership is and where the greatest impact can be made.
Clay Nessler is Vice President of Sustainability with Wisconsin-based Johnson Controls. Dr. Jeff Thompson will also be at this week's Climate Summit in San Francisco. Thompson is CEO Emeritus of Gunderson Health System.
He talked about the process through which Gunderson has become more environmentally responsible.
So we set out on that journey from 2008 to 2014, 15, right in that time period, we were able to drop our pollutants. Are pollutants that asthmatics breathe and heart patients breathe and adult lung patients have to breathe in by 95%, the amount of mercury that's put out in the environment from burning coal by 95%. And we made money, and we did it all with locally sourced energy supply that boosted the local economy. So we're able to do all those things, which is why they asked us to present our story at the Climate Talks in Paris and many other places around the country and around the world. To say, look, this is how a healthcare organization takes care of its community.
So I listened in on a Live from Paris event in which you participated. I think it was during the Paris event in December 2015. And you mentioned then that it's obvious, but not to everyone, that health and climate change are tied together, that also social justice and climate change are intertwined.
Oh, it's very true. You know, like all major struggles, and climate change is listed by virtually everyone that measures it. I mean, geopolitical folks as well as climate people as one of the great struggles of this coming century. It's almost always the least advantaged that get hurt the most. So when the giant heat waves come, it's people that can't afford air conditioning or in marginal situations. They can't afford it's either air conditioning or food, or their medicines. Which do they spend their money on? Because they don't have enough for everything. It is in floods and the people with the least amount of assets that are usually hurt the most. And they don't have generators, and they don't have ways to get out, and they don't have other options. So in times of climate-related migration events, we've seen many places in the world after terrible droughts or terrible flooding. It's those with the least assets that get hurt the most. And so it is, it's going to affect all of us. And even the people that say, well, I'm not in that category. I'm really fine. I'm going to be fine. The truth is the money used to take care of these extreme weather events or the increase in mosquito and other vector-borne illnesses, the effects from bad air quality that kill millions in the world every year, that money could be used for other things. It could be used for roads. It could be used for schools. It could be used for lower taxes. It could be used for a lot of other things. So we just feel that it's a responsible corporate citizen to do that, and that's one of the things that this Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco is going to be about. Is it's not just healthcare organizations, although it'll be many from around the world, but there'll be major businesses around the United States and the world saying this is exactly what we need to do as responsible community and national citizens to take this on.
So in 2015, you said governments can't be responsible for fixing all of the elements that contribute to climate change, but it can smooth the pathway. So do you think that's possible in our current political climate here in the United States?
Oh, sure. I think it is. It's just a different group has to take responsibility instead of expecting a president to lead on this for the long-term good of the whole population. It's just not happening. So other people have to rise up. Corporations can rise up. So states can rise up. Individual organizational groups, Healthcare Without Harm is a national, international organization that organizes health systems. I mean, healthcare is 18% of the United States GDP. If we all get organized towards improving the health of the population broadly, how we source all of our equipment, how we source all our medications, how we use and produce energy, we can have a huge impact. So just sitting back and whining because the president doesn't agree with this is taking the wrong path, in my opinion. And so we just need to take it on.
So you're heading out to San Francisco. What will your role be there, and what do you hope could come out of these discussions?
There's the Global Climate Action Summit. Then there's dozens of other convenings around that gathering. So there's a healthcare one. There's a broader roundtable, an international roundtable that has healthcare. The World Health Organization is there. People from India and China. I'll be on a panel with a leader from China, a leader from India, one from the National Health Service of England, who've done some terrific work to try and understand their impact on their communities. And so we'll do a couple things. Most of all, we'll kind of share best practices. Here's what we did. Here's how we did it. Here are the barriers we had. Here's how we overcame them. So it can be shared with other people around the world. But we'll also try and build paths forward and say, how do we as a group put pressure on international organizations or the international treaties not necessarily political, but get information out to the media so there's a clearer understanding of what the pathway forward could look like. So with a combined power of the governmental agencies that are there and healthcare sector and the IT sector and the business sector, there's a big banking sector that's there that see the impact of disastrous climate on many of their investments. So we put all these sectors together and share best ideas from each one and then develop plans to move forward to say what action do we need to take ourselves and what can we encourage others to do to more quickly move this forward.
Dr. Jeff Thompson is CEO Emeritus of La Crosse-based Gunderson Health System. He's attending this week's Climate Summit, which begins tomorrow in San Francisco. He spoke with Susan Bentz, and you can read more at WUWM.com.
New York Times Magazine correspondent Mark Leibovich set out to take a break from the craziness of politics by writing a book on the NFL. We'll find out how that worked out for him when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It is Tuesday already, but there are more than a few Packers fans still basking in the glow of their comeback victory over Chicago on Sunday night. Many of those same fans were expressing their disgust with the Packers' leadership halfway through the game when the score was lopsided in favor of the Bears.
So it goes with football. It's a little like politics in that way. We support our leaders when we agree with them and want to throw the bums out when we don't. The intersection between pro football and politics is actually pretty substantial, as Mark Leibovich learned over the past few years.
Leibovich is the New York Times Magazine's chief national correspondent. The longtime political reporter's latest book is called Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times, and it took Leibovich around the country to such exotic locales as Green Bay, Wisconsin, for his reporting. He joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So you spent quite a bit of time hanging out with NFL owners. Very uplifting experience that sounds like.
Totally, totally.
What do you think we're missing out on here in Wisconsin by not having that single guy, the Jerry Jones or Robert Kraft or Mark Davis running the show?
You don't know how lucky you are in Wisconsin not to have one of these owners like to grab the microphone 2 seconds after you win a Super Bowl to sort of make it all about them. No, the NFL, I mean, I hope the sort of publicly owned shareholder arrangement that the Packers have can endure, because I'm sure the NFL at some point would love to try to buy the team and make it private and, you know, some billionaire can come in. But I think it's unique and it's great, because I think NFL owners are, you know, they're not the most impressive group of people in the world, and I was pretty surprised that they let me in to the degree they did, because that you know, sports is not my day job. I'm not a sports writer. I'm a political writer. And I will say that if you're putting together like an elite corporate board of like, you know, Federal Express or Bank of America or Apple or something, you would not pick a lot of these guys to be on your elite corporate board. So, look, I mean, they have an amazing amount of power in their various markets. They're all, you know, pretty much billionaires. They're all printing money. And they're all, in many cases, despised in the markets they're in, and often for good reason. But one thing I did find is that the membership, as they call themselves, which is what the group of NFL owners call themselves, is one of the most untold and sort of underappreciated stories we have in America, because this is such a powerful group of people, and they're mysterious, and they're private, and they're secretive, and they're very clubby. And even the president of the United States himself has wanted to get into the club, and as a consolation prize, he got to sit in the White House and, sort of heckle from the bully pulpit. So, I don't know, I was very, it was quite a group of people, and I would much prefer to be a Packers fan and be a shareholder, because I met a lot of Packers fans.
Well, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but the thing that seems to come through in your reporting on these guys is the freedom that they seem to have to say whatever the heck was on their mind, because they're not beholden to anybody, right?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, they're like politicians in that they're sort of entitled, and they have these little kingdoms, and they're used to a certain amount of deference. But the big difference is they don't have to run for re-election. But what's interesting for me, and I cover politics for a living, and so this is a departure for me, but there is this sort of expectation just in dealing with these owners that they would be treated with a level of deference. I mean, they always must be called Mr. So-and-so, and, they're almost all men. It's one of the first things you learn when you go to work at the NFL, is the owners are always to be called Mr. So-and-so. But there was also a weird vibe that, like, you're going to take care of me, right? And, like, no, I'm not going to take care of anyone. Like, I don't know you, and, like, I'm a reporter. And, yeah, I mean, they it was like they were little kings, and I was not impressed. But they also, they own the teams we root for, and they control a big, big slice of the entertainment pie in this country and have for a long time.
You said you wouldn't necessarily want many of these guys on your corporate board. Would you want the guy that is ostensibly running the show to be running to be the CEO of your corporation, Roger Goodell?
Probably not. I mean, I don't think if you're, if you're on the board of Apple or on the board of FedEx or on the board of, L.L. Bean or whatever, you'd want to hire Roger Goodell. I mean, Roger Goodell is uniquely suited, I guess, to run the National Football League, and that he's been, that's the only workplace he's ever known. He came to, had an internship with the New York Jets and sort of never really left. He hasn't worked in any other organization. And, one thing he has been very good at over the years was cultivating and sort of endearing himself to powerful older men, and that's who these owners are. And Roger Goodell's most important job, and pretty much his only job, is to make tons of money for the 32 guys. And again, they're all guys pretty much who run NFL, or who own NFL teams. And he literally has a call sheet on his desk in which he has the exact date and that he last talked to, say, the owner of the Chicago Bears or the owner of the Kansas City Chiefs or whoever. And if a couple of weeks have passed and he hasn't been on the phone talking to Martha Firestone Ford, the 92-year-old matriarch of the Detroit Lions, he'll get on the horn and give Mrs. Ford a call and see how she's doing with the Lions and if she needs anything and if he can get her anything and what her concerns are. And, that's what a politician does.
Well, and it's interesting because it's not that different than what he was doing when he was an intern for the Jets.
Gets paid a lot more, that's for
sure.
Well,
this is true, but but it sounds like they're not looking for a leader. They're looking for a guy to fetch water for.
Correct. He is yes. Well, but with the one caveat, though, is he can also suspend their players and ruin their reputations and kick them out of the league. And it's a weird dynamic. But you're right, though. No, he is the head of a trade association. It is a very, very high-profile trade association. But what a trade association president does is he keeps the members happy. And, whether it's 10 CEOs and the, head of the widget trade association or 32, effective CEOs at the head of the Football Trade Association. That's sort of what he does. And you're right. It's basically about, working in the service industry.
I love that he wanted you to call this book The Shield.
I know, didn't it? Wasn't that awesome? I saw him we're at this party, and they let me into all these parties. I don't quite understand why, but Jerry Jones' induction to the Hall of Fame, party. He threw Jerry Jones probably spent a few million dollars on a party at some country club near Canton, Ohio. And there was Roger Goodell, like, bellied up to the bar, and there I was. And he goes, hey, and it was really loud, I think, because Justin Timberlake was playing live, because Jerry paid him a lot of money to play live. And Goodell said, yeah, hey, what's your name of your book? And I said, I don't really know yet, because it was true. I actually didn't know at that point. And he said, well, what about The Shield? And I don't know if he was kidding or not, but his wife, actually I met his wife at another party, and I asked her what the most ostentatious sort of rendering of the NFL shield was in the Goodell estate in Bronxville, New York. And she mentioned something about a tattoo, which I will let readers find out about if they want.
There was a statistic that you cited that jumped out at me, that it's something like only 8 or 10% of NFL football fans have ever seen a game in person.
7%. Yeah, that's true. Wow. I was stunned by that. Jerry Jones told me that. I mean, that is it's an amazing statistic. Yeah, even though it's hardcore fans in football fans in America, the vast majority of them have never set foot in an NFL stadium.
Well, do you think that puts the league in a more tenuous position than it might be if it were baseball or basketball?
Not really. I mean, I think, look, 60% of their revenues comes from broadcast contracts, and you know, football is a perfect television sport. I mean, it's been true for decades, obviously, but what's perfect about it is the pacing of it, the timing of it, but also just the shape of the field is, like, in perfect symmetry with the way televisions are shaped. And, you know, you could just the camera placement and the HDTV, I mean, just the whole package is just an extremely sort of appealing TV experience. And yeah, look, as a consumer, I would much rather watch a game on TV than, you know, travel out to, in my case, you know, Hyattsville, Maryland, to have to watch the mediocre Washington Redskins, you know, and pay overpriced, you know, parking and sit in traffic. I mean, and not to mention, you know, sitting up in row whatever, trying to make sense of whatever's going on down the field. I mean, it's just much better in every way. So, look, as long as networks keep paying, you know, billions and billions of dollars to the owners, I mean, I think they're going to be fine. So they haven't really, for a long time, haven't really relied that much on attendance as that big a part of their revenue. But having said that, I mean, attendance is usually pretty strong.
Well, and they also, maybe more so than other leagues, really seem to live or die based on, you know, how TV ratings are doing.
TV ratings. Yep, absolutely. There's no question. And look, they mostly perform. I mean, 70, or you know, more than 70 of the top 100 TV shows in America in 2017 last year were all football games. I mean, that is an incredible juggernaut that way. And yeah, it's true. I mean, it does, you know, it's a bit of a luxury. But, you know, I think in other sports, just being there is actually a more sort of a special experience. Now, having said that, I mean, Lambeau Field in Wisconsin, I'd never been there. I mean, of course, part of my book research, I had to go there. I went to a playoff game against the Giants a couple years ago. Aaron Rodgers was just sublime. It was really cold, but it was an amazing experience. And so, you know, Lambeau Field was one of the great sort of must-go-to places, and I really did love that. But for the most part, I would much rather sit at home watching.
Yeah, and in a way, you're writing about Lambeau Field. It felt like, you know, almost a literal breath of fresh air.
It really did. I mean, well, first of all, it was—I could see my breath. It was very cold, but I loved it. It was actually, and this is interesting. I mean, sort of in the context of my day job, I mean, covering politics. This was, you know, a few weeks after the election, and the election was such a divisive and, just really draining experience. I think for everyone, no matter, you know, what side you're on or what you do for a living. I mean, I didn't realize this, but you know, Green Bay, you know, very 50-50. Area. I mean, I think, you know, it was like, I think Trump won by maybe 1% of the vote. But look, the only thing, it wasn't a red and blue experience at all after a whole election. It was a green and yellow experience. And Peter King, the longtime NFL writer, then for Sports Illustrated, now for NBC, gave me the best advice. I mean, a lot of people were giving me like restaurant advices, but he said, no, just get, you know, wear plenty of layers, show up 5 or 6 hours early, just sort of walk through the tailgate areas and just strike up conversations. You're going to be very, very well fed. And he was absolutely right. So.
That was I have been to Lambeau once, and it was reporting exactly the same experience.
Ah, loved it. It was terrific. I hope to go back.
Yeah, me too. You mentioned President Trump's attempt to become part of this owner club. He owned a USFL team with the apparent hopes of you know, getting a merger and having the New Jersey Generals join the NFL at some point. He tried and failed to buy the Buffalo Bills a few years ago. How much of the president's attitude to the NFL do you think we should connect to his inability to become part of that club?
I'm guessing it's related. I mean, like, look, with a lot of things with President Trump, I mean, there is some kind of personal grievance tied up in it, you know. And, I mean, he feels like in going after Amazon, for instance. I mean, he has a lot of reasons for it. But ultimately, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, also owns the Washington Post, who he feels that has been very hard on him. And so he, you know, has been encouraging the Postal Service to, you know, be harder on Amazon. So, no, it's not unprecedented. But, you know, the NFL is like kind of a perfect hobby horse for him because you're right. I mean, they did not have him as a member, and he can sort of terrorize them from the White House. But he also – he feels it's a winning issue for him. I mean, you know, attacking the NFL over the national anthem protest is something that he obviously thinks that his base loves, and he thinks public opinion on his side, and he's probably right. And, you know, as we get closer to the midterm elections, I think we'll be hearing more from him on this. So, I mean, I think with many things, with a lot of things, it is a combination of personal grievance, sort of political opportunism, and also probably, you know, a genuine some passion for the issue.
It is amazing, though, because, you know, football tends to skew conservative, and he's managed to turn a lot of really hardcore conservatives against football.
It's true. I mean, I think traditionally, you know, liberals have been more suspicious of football than conservatives. I mean, liberals, you know, whether it's the violence of the game or the sort of over-the-top patriotism or the military sort of model of leadership in the game, you know, traditionally you've sort of seen that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think Donald Trump, I mean, even before Colin Kaepernick started protesting during the national anthem, I mean, Trump on the campaign trail would go off on these riffs about how football has been ruined by all these rule changes and all these penalty flags, and it's gotten so politically correct. And I remember there was one particularly ugly game between the Steelers and the Bengals during the wild card round of the playoffs a few years ago. A lot of personal fouls and ejections and concussions and bad fan behavior. And a couple of days later on the campaign trail in Nevada, he said, you know, look, I was watching that game, and there were so many flags, and you used to have these great violent hits, and you don't have them anymore. And he made the point that, you know, football has gone soft and America has gone soft. So, like, there's a metaphor right there, right? And, you know, to me, that was a lot of the Trump campaign in a nutshell. And obviously, you know, it had a very responsive audience in the football heartland, which was also the Trump heartland, whether it's, you know, parts of the Midwest like Ohio or Pennsylvania or, you know, then Alabama and Texas and the South. I mean, that follows pretty closely on the Trump sort of coalition.
All right, so I'm going to out you as a Patriots fan here, and in doing so, I'll out myself.
I'm
as
one
a
of the
Patriots
good ones,
fan.
Though. I buy my book, everyone. I'm good. You know, we're not all bad.
But one of the things that you did in the course of reporting this book is you got to talk with and spend plenty of time, or some time anyway, with Tom Brady. And you know, thinking of you as a Patriots fan and imagining, you know, the esteem with which you would have held Tom Brady, what do you think spending that time, you know, how you run the risk when you get to know your sports heroes of knowing them in a way that you might not want to?
True. Yeah, no, I mean, look, I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, I've loved sports for a long time, and I've never covered sports, and I've never been a sports writer, and people have asked, you know, well, why don't you just be a sports writer? And I said, you know, but I feel like as soon as I get too close to this, and as soon as it becomes a job, I will stop loving sports as a fan. And it was interesting with Brady. I mean, I didn't expect to get to, you know, spend any time with him, but I did for whatever reason. But, you know, I've interviewed presidents and vice presidents and CEOs and, you know, celebrity types, and I don't think I'd ever been as nervous as like when I went up to meet Tom Brady. I mean, I was tried not to be starstruck. And what was interesting is in the season I spent with him, all of a sudden at the end, he was accused of deflating footballs and being like a terrible cheater and everything. And Deflategate was happening. And I had to like ask some pretty tough questions. And he wasn't talking to a lot of people at that time. So I had to, you know, be very careful to check my my fanboy tendencies at the door. But no, I mean, luckily, Tom didn't do anything that that really disappointed me in any way. I mean, he's a really, you know, pretty down-to-earth, you know, private, somewhat shy guy off the field. He's not the most colorful figure off the field, but he is a hell of a quarterback and obviously extremely focused and extremely disciplined about his craft. And, you know, I came away impressed, and I really liked his family a lot, especially, you know, his parents in the Bay Area are lovely people. And it's not easy to play the game he has at his level, you know, for as long as he has, to say the least. But also, I think he's basically carried himself in public with a kind of grace and kind of perspective on just the absurd level of success and scrutiny he's been under, and also just the absurd, you know, level of, you know, good fortune he's had to be where he is today. So I don't know. I did like him. I think I probably would have said that even if I didn't have my bias in favor of the team I grew up rooting for. And so luckily he didn't go ruining anything by being a jerk.
Do you think your own attitude towards football has changed for having done this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was asked that a couple times. I don't know. I mean, I'm actually really curious to see how I respond to this year, because I am sick of writing about it. I'm sick of, you know, like with anyone who you talk to who's written a book, you're really glad to be done with the topic, and certainly glad with the book. But I think this year it'll be really nice to be able to maybe watch without having to worry about, you know, is this going to go in the book? Is this relevant to the book? Am I working now? But at the same time, look, I mean, I feel like I know a lot more, and that's not always a good thing. And I think there might come a time when I might just say, you know, enough of this. And I will say that it is an exhausting league to watch these days. The games are not always great. I mean, I actually fell asleep last night watching the opener between the this is being taped on a Friday, so this was last night between the Falcons and the Eagles. The Eagles won, but God, it was a really dull game. And so we'll see where it all leads. I mean, I guess I assume if there's compelling football, I'll watch it. But I'm also I'm more into the NBA now than I have been in a while. So maybe that's where maybe they will absorb some of my sporting passions.
Well, listen, Mark Leibovich, this book is head and shoulders above any other football book I can remember reading. So
outstanding. Thank you.
I'm really grateful. And yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on, Mitch. And you know, go Pack. Well, we won't tell anyone about the Patriots thing. We'll just edit all that out, right?
Yes, exactly.
Go Packers. We love the Packers.
Mark Leibovich's new book is called Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. His previous books include This Town and Citizens of the Green Room. We reached him on the line in Washington.
And he and I do humbly apologize to Packers Nation for gushing over Tom Brady.
We'll take one more break and then a chat with Milwaukee metalsmith Sarah Mann and a visit to her studio. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Wisconsin Designer Crafts Council is a century-old organization which was founded in Milwaukee. It works to promote fine craft throughout the state through events like the yearly Morning Glory Fine Crafts Fair, which took place back in August.
Among the artists that the organization supports through these events is metalsmith Sarah Mann. Mann grew up in Milwaukee before moving away for school and other work. She's been back in the area for a while now, though, and she works out of her studio in the basement of her Whitefish Bay home. That's where I met her this summer to find out more about her and her work.
I studied metalsmithing when I was in college in St. Louis at Washington University under a phenomenal artist, Heikki Seppä. And that's really where my love of metalsmithing came from. I love the permanence of working in metal. I worked in a lot of different other medium, and metalsmithing really took my heart. And then I moved to New Orleans and started working for a metalsmith there. And on the side, I was doing my own metalsmithing and realized that I was devoting so much time to his work and I could do my own work instead. And so I took a leap of faith and started my own business.
But you're from here, right? Did you start doing art here in Milwaukee?
Actually, I did. I started, before I went to Washington University when I was in high school, I was taking metalsmithing classes at UWM in the evening just for fun. And those were casting classes. And those were just for fun, and it didn't occur to me that I could make a career out of it until I went to school and then pursued it after that in my own business.
When you look at a piece of metal that has not yet become something, where do you start? Are you thinking of something ahead of time, or do you let the metal tell you what it needs to be?
I've worked in other metals, but I work pretty much for my own work in silver. And that's what appeals to me most. It's what I've always been drawn to. I think I like the color of it. I like how the metal itself is workable, the strength of it, the way that it bends and melts. So I love silver out of all the metals that I've worked with most. And so I think of what I do for each. I tend to work in series of work. Like I put out two or three series of work a year. That includes necklaces and bracelets and rings and earrings, of course. And with each series, I'm responding to something that piqued my interest, either aesthetically, a shape or some sort of kinetic element or a challenge that I'm working through. So yeah, those are generally the things that I'm responding to with each series.
So it's not the metal itself so much that's dictating to you what it needs to be. It's something else that you then work with the metal to explore.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you always work in jewelry, or do you also do sculpture and things that are not wearable?
Pretty much only jewelry. And I design my own pieces and make them. But I also do custom work for people who want specific things. They have to be within my vocabulary and style. But yeah, so that's how I work.
Like what? What would you consider something? If I were to come to you and say, I'd like something, what kinds of things would you be comfortable doing?
Well, I don't typically work in stones, although I do some pieces for myself every once in a while. But sometimes folks will come to me and they'll want a stone set, or they have a particular design idea in mind, like they want a necklace, but they're not sure how to execute it, and they usually know me and my work, so they're comfortable with my design style and having it in that style, and so I'll just hear what they want to have done and draw up some sketches, and we'll work together in getting it executed.
Well, that takes me right into executing from concept to actual piece holding in your hand or wearing it or whatever it is. Do you start with sketches?
Typically, yes. It's always helpful to see it on paper before working in metal, because you don't really want to waste the metal. You don't want to practice so much on the metal. Although I have a pretty good sense of how the metal is going to respond and what it's going to look like, that oftentimes I do dive in right onto the metal, but I like to draw it out, because it's amazing what's revealed in the drawing that you're not necessarily thinking about. And as it comes to life on the paper, then you can do some problem solving and see what needs to be adjusted and tweaked. And then the same thing happens once you bring it from paper drawing into the metal. Things always change and evolve, so it's fun to see how things take shape over the course of a thought coming to life in a piece of jewelry.
Has there ever been a piece that you drew out on paper and thought, oh, this is going to be fantastic, and then when you tried to make it in metal said, I can't do this, for whatever reason? You didn't think through a certain part of the process or something?
Definitely, yes. That happens, and sometimes I get the sense when I'm drawing it out or when I'm testing it out, I just get this gut feeling that this isn't where I want to be heading. And sure enough, it doesn't turn into anything that I'm really pleased about. But that's sort of like the happy accident phenomenon. Even if that piece isn't something that I'm interested in, it usually leads to another train of thought that will turn into a piece of jewelry that I like. So it's important to follow all of those little roads to see where they might lead.
Even if it's quote-unquote a mistake, it's a good mistake.
You got it. And sometimes those mistakes I just keep around, and I'll revisit them and see if I can adjust them and turn them into something else or use a part of it. Or so nothing is ultimately a mistake. It always sort of turns into something that I might use or at least trigger some train of thought that will turn into something that I really like.
So how long have you been doing this as a profession?
Oh, over 25 years.
Okay, so that's a long time. In that 25 years, how do you feel your design aesthetic has changed?
Some things haven't changed at all. Like, they're very recognizable as things that I would make. My style in some ways has remained pretty similar, but other things have made big leaps. Like, I used to work big, chunky, maybe that's a 1980s thing, that it was, the jewelry was much bigger and chunkier and kind of heavier. And now my work is a little bit more organic and light. So I think that's been a trend in my jewelry. Interestingly, it's coincided with my eyesight kind of fading and my needing sharper glasses as I'm working smaller. So
it's funny how that works. It's like, oh my goodness. Yeah, you'd think you'd almost go to the opposite, to the bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think also the way that my jewelry has trended aesthetically really reflects what I like. I mean, all the jewelry that I make over the years has always been something that I've wanted to wear myself before presenting it to the public. So I guess I'm sort of interested in jewelry that's smaller, maybe a little bit more delicate, lighter, easier to wear, less sculptural in some ways.
The thing I love about jewelry, well, yes, I love to wear it, but thinking of it on a slightly higher level, the thing I love about it is it is adornment. It is art that we wear, that we present to the world. And, you know, a lot of times on this show, I've had discussions with particularly fine craftspeople, fine artisans, about that line between craft and art. And I don't think it really exists. I think that's kind of a made-up thing, that you have as much skill and as much artistic vision as a jeweler as you do as a painter. It's just a different medium. Do you find that people think of you, or have you ever had to push back at that idea that's like, no, I really am an artist, even though I work with something that you ultimately are going to wear as opposed to hang on your wall?
Mm-hmm. No, that's never been an issue. At least I haven't experienced it as not being recognized as an artist. There's an advantage of being a jeweler, that the pieces are worn, so they might be a little bit more accessible to the general public, and people tend to gravitate towards jewelry when I'm doing shows, because it's an easy gift to give also. So not only are people purchasing for themselves, but they're purchasing for loved ones. But I've never had a problem with being recognized as an artist, and maybe that's has something to do with my style of work. It doesn't look very commercial. It's very sort of artistic looking.
It has a point of view, which I think is really important. And, you know, we're sitting here at your table looking at some examples of your work. And the two things that have jumped out at me is that ring over there. I'll have you describe all of this. And then these earrings right here. And to me, they have a very specific style and point of view, like any art.
Right. And both of them are very sort of technique driven. I learned different techniques right before I made the series that both of those pieces that you're pointing out were designed and made. There's something else that I like to incorporate in all of my work, and that's a surface treatment. So the style of jewelry is described as pretty modern and clean designs, simple in a certain way, but highly stylized also. And even in their simplicity, there's little details about the work that if you look closely, you'll notice the different surface treatments. And for example, on the ring that you're pointing out, it has what's called a Mizzi wheel texture, which is a rotating stone that I draw across the surface. So it really brings the piece to life in a certain way. And same thing with the earrings that you're pointing out. This has a different sort of texture on it. So even in the simplicity of the design, it adds a little depth to the piece.
Give me an idea of how long it takes you from start to finish. And I realize that would change depending on how complicated the piece is. But let's say this ring that I'm drawn to, how long approximately did that take you to make?
Well, not taking into consideration the design time, if I'm just talking about the construction, I'd say a couple of hours. There's different parts of the process of making the piece, and then you have to let it sit in what's called a pickle, and then I put a patina on it, and then that tumbles in order to remove some of the patina and just leave the highlights shining. And so it's not a couple of hours straight through. It takes several hours with breaks in between where I'm putting my focus and attention on other pieces.
So how many are you working on at any given time?
Well, I like to think of my jewelry as not one-of-a-kind pieces, but a limited edition where I make several pieces. So if I'm getting ready for a show like the Morning Glory Fine Craft Fair that's coming up, I'll make a few, particularly in the ring department, so that I can have several ring sizes for people to try on. And then I just keep the piece alive as long as I'm interested in making it and as long as people are interested in buying it. But as soon as I'm done, I'm done. And every once in a while, I'll revive a piece from the past or I'll alter it from its original design to bring it into something a little bit more current or something that I'm a little bit more interested in making, or I'll solve a problem on it that I want to work on. So I make a piece, several pieces, and then I'll either retire it or keep it going. Like, there's a pair of earrings that I have one of my first pair of earrings, and I'm still making it 25 years later. I just love them. They really are like little sculptures for your ears. And then there's other pieces that I've retired after a year because they're really challenging to make, or they're just not getting enough reception, or whatever the case may be, I retire a piece too.
If someone, a young person, came to you and said, I want to be a jeweler, what's the most important thing you can pass on to them that you've learned over 25 years of doing this?
Follow your own design style. Do not try to figure out what people want and make what they want. Figure out what you like, make what you like. And if you're really passionate about your work, there's someone out there who's going to be equally passionate about purchasing it. I guarantee it.
Well, Sarah Mann, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Metalsmith Sarah Mann spoke with us at her Whitefish Bay studio. You can see some pictures of Mann at work, as well as some photos of her finished pieces at WUWM.com. Our interview first aired in August as she was about to present her work at the Morning Glory Fine Crafts Fair. That's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.